When we started a little bit on this American Heritage series, I didn't know how far we should go, and I think it's time to stop, so tonight I'm going to try to just sort of wrap up some things. And next Tuesday night I'm going to begin a series on predestination and election. We'll be covering in that series issues about predestined election from certain theological points of view. We'll be dealing with definitions. It'll probably take till the time that I'm scheduled to go to California to finish that. I've had an awful lot of questions about predestination and election lately, and I thought, well, there's this little time lag in here that maybe we can put that in on Tuesday nights. Okay. And what we've been saying basically is that the colonies in the United States of America could be looked upon as an experiment in religious expression. Now, we began this series by saying that in Europe, many aspects of the Reformation, particularly what is called the left wing of the Reformation, many of these thoughts and concepts and biblical points of view were stymied by the magisterial reformers. They were not permitted to function. And so, in a sense, they squeezed out of Europe, or they slid out from under the boot in Europe that was on their neck, and they came to this country. And in this country, they found various attitudes relative toward religious expression. If you lived in New England during the colonial period, you were not allowed to express yourself unless you did in a congregational manner. In other words, from a congregational reform point of view, because New England was looked upon as the new Israel, a theocracy that God had permitted the Puritans to establish. New York, Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia eventually, over a period of time, the Anglican Church was established. In Virginia, it was established very, very early in their history. Same way in Georgia and the Carolinas. Maryland was a haven for Catholics. It was founded by a Catholic, Lord Baltimore II. But in Maryland, they were forced to grant religious liberty. Never let a Catholic tell you that Maryland was a pioneer in religious liberty. The only reason they were is because they were forced to by the climate of opinion in this country. They never could have existed if they didn't grant freedom of religion. But they really didn't grant freedom of religion because they banned Jews and Unitarians. So if you were a Jew and a Unitarian, you came to this country, you couldn't go to Maryland. In New Jersey, the Quakers were not allowed to vote. In Pennsylvania and Delaware, you had probably the greatest amount of religious freedom anywhere. But again, there was a little bit of a qualification there. You had freedom for those who believed in God. So if you were an atheist, well, you didn't have a chance there. Now, in other words, what we're saying is that many of the colonists left Europe for freedom to worship. But once they were here, they didn't want to grant too much liberty, depending on their point of view or why they came here. Well, last week we looked at a little bit at the Constitution, or some of the thoughts that were instrumental in the writing of the Constitution. And if you had a timeline running something like this, we could mark this date of the Bill of Rights, 1789, as a very, very watershed, a watershed date, a watershed event relative to religious expression and the freedom of religion in this country. The Bill of Rights was proposed by James Madison, and it's probably the most unique part of the Constitution of the United States. For in it, are spelled out, or were spelled out, the rights that every native or every citizen of this country could enjoy, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. The one that we are most interested in terms of this series is the Establishment Clause. I guess we have to change the name of that in 1975, 76, I guess it is, since the word establishment has the wrong connotation. The Establishment Clause is the first amendment to the Constitution and the first part of it, which says, Congress shall make no law. Congress shall make no law. Respecting an establishment of religion. Now that's the Establishment Clause. The second clause is called the Free Exercise Clause, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So what we're saying is that in the First Amendment, the first seemingly order of priority, at least it comes first chronologically in those amendments, respects religion. It is dealing with the freedom of religion and the freedom from religion. In other words, it grants to the citizens of this country that they would have freedom of expression, that would be the exercise clause, and they would have freedom from coercion, from being forced by law to be involved with some religion, whether it be financial or physical presence or what. Now that is a watershed, we said. That is a landmark. We benefit from all the good that came out of that. But unless you know something about history, and particularly the history of religion and even the history of Christianity, you can't appreciate what that meant, because there was no such thing till this time. Perhaps the closest thing we said to it was in Pennsylvania. In Virginia, their assembly passed a freedom of religion clause approximately maybe 9-10 years before this. In other words, they had a Bill of Rights in Virginia before this, and this is patterned somewhat after that. But again, it was late, and again, it had an established church. Now, as you probably know, the expression that we have in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights, of liberties that we are to enjoy as citizens, has to be interpreted by the Supreme Court of the United States. In other words, there's not a lot written in our Constitution. They did not cover all the bases, so to speak. They tried to. And since that time, how many amendments do we have now? What's the Equal Rights Amendment? What would that be, 24? Anybody know? What number would that be, 25? We've had 14 more anyhow, which means all the bases weren't covered. And then in the working out of the details of this, as to what this meant, would be sort of left up to the Supreme Court. For example, we now have a problem in the free exercise of religion, don't we? In what respect? What aren't we allowed to do now? Pray in public schools. The way I followed that decision, and much of the literature surrounding that back in the 60s when that all began, and the way I understand that law, it's not that you can't pray, It's that you cannot write a prayer, or no one can compose a prayer, no school board can compose a prayer. Nobody could compose a prayer and then impose it upon students. Now, this is what the Supreme Court outlawed back in, it was around 61 or so, okay? Now, what that has come to mean in practice is you can't pray, you see. And I don't know, I have not followed that case closely since 61, 62, whatever it was. If somebody says you can't, the law said you couldn't pray, they don't understand that law, or they don't understand the decision of the Supreme Court. Well, what I'm saying is that many of the things in the Bill of Rights we're still struggling with. Perhaps the most poignant expression of this is the issue of the freedom of the press and the right of a fair trial by jury. That's probably the one closest to us right now. That the media gets a hold of information and it's so vast in its publication, it's so speedy that everybody's confronted with the information and they've already determined that the person that's accused is already guilty. And so when they go to select the jury, they have to, it's a nightmare to select the jury now. Have you heard, have you read this information on this trial? For instance, yesterday the Rocky Mountain News published an article called Contract Killing. They went into the details of the grand jury information on this contract killing. Where did they get the information? How did it leak? How are they going to be able to try these people in Denver now on a fair trial? See what I'm saying? So what the judges have done, it's happened in Nebraska, and I think it's happened in Grand Junction also, they put a gag order on all the reporters, on everyone involved in the case, the defense, the prosecution. Nobody can talk about the case. Because the judge is saying, they're opting for Article 6 or Amendment 6 of the Bill of Rights over Amendment Number 1. Amendment Number 1 goes on to define the freedom of the press. Well, the Establishment Clause relative to freedom of religion was very shortly interpreted by Madison and Jefferson to mean a wall of separation. Whatever they meant, it came very shortly to mean a wall of separation between church and state. Some argued that what the writers of the Constitution meant was that they didn't want to have a national church. As per what country? England, okay, England, the Anglican Church, or Sweden, the Lutheran Church, Italy, the Catholic Church, and so on, see, where the church is supported by taxes. In other words, your money goes to support a church. So what many who lived in the era of the Constitution said, well, all they meant was that they didn't want to have a national church. Now, when this was written, there were five states that still had a state church within the state. In other words, if you lived in that state, your tax monies went to support that state, that church in that state. And I think Massachusetts, I'm not sure about the date, but I think it was 1854, before they do away with the Congregational Church in Massachusetts as the state church. I just can't imagine living under a system like that. I mean, I'd have moved to somewhere out of there. I'd have got out on an island or somewhere where I didn't have to pay my monies unless I was a Congregationalist. It's unfathomable to me that money would go to a church. My tax money would go to a church. That, you know, makes my hair stand on end. Well, there were five states like that when the Constitution was written. In the other states, it was the Anglican Church that was established. And in which, if you lived there, your tax monies went to pay the pastors of the Anglican churches, whether you liked it or not. Well, eventually, The Supreme Court ruled that under the 14th Amendment, all of the clauses in the First Amendment apply to the states. In other words, the 14th Amendment becomes sort of a catch-all. And they say that everything in the First Amendment applies to all the states. And if there were a state that had a church at that time, that would have been outlawed. But by that time, the states had already taken upon themselves responsibility to do away with state churches. Well, what this comes to mean then is freedom of religion. Freedom of religion. And I'm speaking here mainly of religious expression. It also comes to mean freedom from religion or religious coercion or somebody forcing a church upon you. Now, unfortunately today, in some very real senses, it has come to mean separation of state and God. Now, the proof that it didn't mean that to the original writers of the Constitution was the fact that they hired a chaplain for the House. Does the Senate have a chaplain? There's a highfalutin, maybe they don't need one, but yeah, I think they have a chaplain. The Supreme Court has a chaplain. Every session of the Supreme Court is opened by prayer. Every session of the House of Representatives is opened by prayer. Now, that's indicative that they didn't mean that Amendment number one meant separation from God. But one of the issues that we're facing in our day is the issue of a sectarian society that kind of views the state as almost irresponsible in terms of their responsibility to God. Well, that's a misunderstanding, of course, of the First Amendment of the Constitution. Okay, now up until that time, what we're saying essentially is that until that time, if we were to go back to our timeline, we did not really have freedom of religion in this country, even though many came here looking for freedom of religion. Here is 1789, and we have Amendment number one. That was the Bill of Rights. Now, in New England, we had an Anglican or a congregational establishment. In New York, by 1794, Virginia by 1619, North and South Carolina, which was originally just simply the Carolinas, and Georgia, we had the Anglican Church established. In New Jersey, Quakers couldn't vote. By the way, in New England, if you weren't a member of the Congregational Church, you couldn't vote under any situation. In PA, you had the closest thing you have to freedom of religion. You had freedom of religious expression for all who believe in God. In other words, you had to be theist. So you had a sort of a freedom for theists. In Maryland, there was a ban on atheists and anti-Trinitarians. Couldn't be a Unitarian and live there. Now, I remember some of this found a kind of a harsh expression, particularly in New England. For instance, in there's sort of a landmark in 1659 when William Robinson and Marmaduke Stevenson and Mary Dyer, three Quakers, came to Boston. They wouldn't take their hats off to the Puritans. They had been warned not to invade that colony with their heretical doctrines. A law had been passed the previous year that that the Quakers would be put to death. So in 1659, they had a test case. And they tried these three people, two men and a woman. And the general court that had passed the law did it with some reluctance. The vote was only 13 to 12 the previous year to pass that law. So they found these three guilty, and they marched them down the street, the main street of Boston, to the hanging, what they called the hanging hill. And in order to muffle out any outcry that these three people would have, they surrounded them with five or six drummers, so that when Mary Dyer or these men tried to cry out to the crowds that were gathering, they couldn't be heard. So they took William Robinson first, and they put the noose around his neck and they hung him. Then they stretched out Marmaduke Stevenson. Now, hanging is a terrible thing to see. It would be a good method, if we're going to continue capital punishment, it would surely be a good method to discourage people from crime. I won't describe it in detail. Well, it came Mary Dyer's term, and they put the noose around her neck, and there had been a pre-planned outcry, and they cried out, no, stop, stop, she's been pardoned. And that had been planned by the general court, and they felt that that would be enough to discourage. There was a lot of resistance to this among the Puritans. So they let Mary Dyer go, and they expelled her from the colony, but 6 months later she came back, so that time they just took her and strung her up. There was also the Salem witch trials in 1691 and 2 that we mentioned, in which 19 witches in Salem, Mass. Were hung. By the way, did you see the report in North Carolina that there is now a witch case, that will go to court in North Carolina, where a woman who claims to be a witch predicted the death of a mother in the community the day that she would die, and she died. And one of the high school boys that was at the seance turned evidence on this witch, and she is now accused of this. I don't know what the accusation is, but it's supposed to come to trial in North Carolina in 1976. Well, what we're saying is that up until this point, you see, you really do not have freedom of religion or freedom from religion in this country. But the Establishment Clause of the Bill of Rights from 1789 on, the interpretation of that amendment is going to affect the development of the church down through time. For instance, when did Joe Smith have his vision? I don't remember. New York, goes to Ohio, goes to Indiana, Illinois, was it? And under his system, it was okay to have more than one wife for the Mormons. Well, there was a lot of resistance to that within the community, and it ended up that one Mormon was killed. And then doesn't Joe Smith die there? I don't remember the details of that. But anyhow, they decide to migrate west. And as you know, they migrate to the Great Salt Plain, around Salt Lake City. And there they sought to establish their own community in which they could have a multiplicity of wives. That would be one of the distinctions that they would have. Well, when Utah became part of the territory of the United States, shortly after that, there was an anti-bigamy law passed by Congress. And the fine for that was something like $5,000 and 2 years in jail or something like that. Well, sure enough, there was a test case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. It's called Reynolds versus the United States. Now, Mr. Reynolds, who was a Mormon, claimed in 1862 that bigamy act interfered with his freedom of religion, because in his religion, it was right for him to have more. It wasn't only right for him to have more than one wife, but it had been prophesied by one of their prophets, I don't know if it was Brigham Young or Joe Smith, that if they didn't have more than one wife, that they would suffer condemnation in the afterlife. So it became a pressure situation to have more than one wife. And for some men, you'd have to be, you know, they only want one. I mean, one is enough for some men. Well, that case went all the way, as we said, to the Supreme Court. And the Chief Justice, whose name was Waite, then said marriage, in his decision, he was in the majority, marriage is a civil contract regulated by law. Upon it, society is built, and out of its fruit springs social duties, responsibilities, obligations, with which the social responsibilities and obligations, the government has to deal with these. And so in sort of a pragmatic way, because of the responsibility of government to society, they upheld the Anti-Bigamy Act of Congress of 1862 and found Reynolds guilty. Now, if you know, as you move down toward our present time, these are not people not claiming to believe in God. Down in our present time now, we have new issues that are rising. For instance, we have the Satanic Church. I read in an article about the occult not long ago that in San Diego they have 25, this person was writing claimed to be a witch from Denver, and he said that in San Diego they have 25 to 30 covens of satanic worshipers. Now what about when they claim their income tax deduction for their church? There are issues rising here that it looks to me like that something's going to come out of it relative to law. Or if it doesn't, if something isn't done, then it would indicate a weakness on the part of our culture. If something isn't said, if there isn't some test case that comes out of it, it should be interesting. These far left groups, radical revolutionaries, have learned about income tax for religious groups, and they call some of their communes, they'll take a religious name, when really there isn't any religious, there isn't an identity with God in it at all. But they learned that under that system, under the law, under that system, they can claim income tax deduction for that type of a situation. Well, what we're saying essentially is that this clause, this non-establishment clause, which sort of guarantees a freedom of religious expression, it would take time for those varied expressions to come forth. Now we have something so far removed, something the writers of the Constitution probably never anticipated would happen, the Satanic Church. And I imagine, I haven't checked this, but I imagine that they do qualify for an income tax deduction status. What, of course, has come to pass is that we live under a Constitution, but the Constitution is what the judges say it is. And that is a direct quote from Chief Justice Hughes of the Supreme Court from 1930 to 1941, and that is correct. Probably the most nine most powerful men in the world sit on the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, I feel that that First Amendment has done much good. Establishment Clause of the American Constitution contributed to what would follow, see? So over here, you see, here we have 1789. In a sense, we have guaranteed. We have guaranteed freedom of religion. Okay? Now it's going to take time for that to express itself, as we said. And for the character and the nature of religion in the United States to develop religious expression. And what I'd like to do in sort of a summary of this is to give you some of these outstanding characteristics of what happens in American Protestantism. Okay? And I have five down. We may come up with some more before we're done. These are outstanding. Now, I'm not looking at minor details. I'm looking at outstanding characteristics of American Protestantism. And I'm using that term very loosely. Well, not loosely. I'm using it in the sense of all that it should connotate. It encompasses liberals, Protestants, it encompasses conservatives, it encompasses fundamentalist Protestants, okay? And these are outstanding characteristics. That which makes or marks off the nature and character of Protestantism in America in the 20th century. And I feel that many of these can be traced back to that establishment clause as a source or an opportunity, as a springboard for these to develop. In other words, what I'm saying is that America, as we said in the beginning of this series, looks to Europe for its roots and its origins. But the church in America is different than the church in Europe. The final religious product was an Americanized Christianity with its own characteristics, you see. And one of the great contributors to that was this freedom of religion. Now, the first thing that I want to point out about the outstanding characteristic of American Protestantism is the voluntary principle. The voluntary principle. Now, this means a church based upon voluntarism. Church or churches. I'm speaking of Protestant churches now, are based upon the principle of voluntarism. Now, in most cases, that's true. In some cases, you are baptized as a child, and in a sense, you are identified with a church, even within Protestantism. But in most cases, that is very little meaning today. It doesn't hold anybody there. In evangelical churches, the voluntary principle is an asset to the maintenance of a pure church. In other words, the evangelical church preaches the new birth and preaches identity with the church on a strictly voluntary basis for people who are regenerated. And nobody from outside can force somebody on that church. It has to be a regenerated constituency according to their own constitutions, and then it has to be on a voluntary principle. And hence, it has helped maintain a pure church. Now, when we started, we said that when you have a system that allows for these divine institutions, here are divine institutions for the whole human race. We said responsibility is one. We said family or marriage. We said family. We said civil law. And we said nation states or nationalism. And all of these are permeated or shot through with authority, morality, and volition. Now, the plus side of the voluntary principle
super plus side, of course, is this exercise of volition. But one of the problems with the voluntary type church is the problem of responsibility. For instance, people can be very, very irresponsible relative to a local church under this type of a system. Nobody's hounding them, nobody's pressuring them. And the normal trend of the sin nature is that it is irresponsible. Now, another way that the irresponsibility manifests itself is in the authority. These two areas are kind of, you know, it's kind of up to the individual here. Irresponsibility and disrespect for authority can become a negative side of a voluntary principle. Here is a person who dislikes the doctrine of a church, and so he just leaves, and he tries to find one that he likes the doctrine in. And maybe he needs to change his doctrine. Maybe he needs to be confronted with Scripture and change his position doctrinally. But he doesn't do it. He sloughs off the responsibility of examining the Word to see whether this is so and simply slides out and goes somewhere else. Or maybe he's somebody that's under the discipline of a church. Maybe he's been involved in fornication and will not admit to the evil that he is doing. He won't even face up to it. And he comes under the discipline of a church. Oh, he just slides out and goes somewhere else. You see? So one of the problems that the voluntary principle, this is a great principle, but in terms of practice and effect on the character of a church and an individual, sometimes there are loopholes and an emphasis such that the voluntary principle gets perverted, or some other aspects of responsibility get perverted. Okay? Under this system, churches must hold their members on the basis of the inherent strength of the church. Is that good? Of course it's good. Sure. In other words, the church itself must see to it that it is walking in the will of the Lord and fulfilling the New Testament implications about the church, and that makes it a strong church. It'll make it inherently strong. And the church will hold its people on that basis. If somebody is has a superficial ministry, can't hold the believers too long. Can't happen. They're going to go. Okay, so it is a good principle. Any questions about that? That's an outstanding characteristic of Protestantism in the 20th century. And it's a result of amendment. One of the things it's a result of is the First Amendment to the Constitution. Okay. Two. Second, the democratic principle. The democratic principle. And we're referring here to a principle and also an atmosphere. Now, in every country, or in practically every country, you can trace a direct relationship between the political structure of the country and the nature of religious forms in the country. Most church organizations in America are modeled after the American form of government. People that sit in the pew are given the opportunity to guide the church. There is a democratic atmosphere, a voting type situation. It's particularly true of the Baptists, the Old Methodists, Presbyterians, and so on. Now, that atmosphere affects the liturgy, too, of a fellowship. It's tended to produce non-liturgical church services. The attitude toward the pastor in most of these Protestant churches is that he is a sort of primus inter pares, or first among equals. He is not overly exalted in terms of his function, or in terms of his person, maybe we should say. Okay? Now, nowhere in the New Testament do you ever read of any congregation taking a vote about anything. In other words, the congregational system of church government, of all the systems of church government that exist, the congregational system, or the voting system, is the newest in history of all forms of church government. As you move back in time, you go something like this. You have, this is called congregational church government. Dates from, I guess you'd have to say it dates from the Congregationalists. You move back to the Presbyterian form, which is somewhat synodical. You've moved back to the, from there to the Episcopal form. And in the Episcopal form, you, of course, you'd have the Anglican and the Roman Catholic. And then as you move back in time, you have the Apostolic Church. New Testament. Now, this form of government that we're talking about here with this democratic principle, this dates from the 17th century. It's the newest form of church government. Now, it runs typically like any corporation, or like the American government. One head, a board, and voting members. Okay? The third outstanding characteristic of American Protestantism. And by the way, this somewhat distinguishes the United States. You have Protestant, we have two things going here that sort of work together. You have Protestant individualism, and denominationalism. Okay? The ideas of the Protestant Reformation run their course, as we said, in America more than any, more than in Europe. Under this idea, you have the Protestant ideal of individual judgment and individual responsibility. No one is looked up. We don't have any Protestant popes. We don't have any high priests of hermeneutics, except as we get into cultic Protestantism, the cultus of a one-man type movement in which he is exalted over all other Bible teachers, that type of thing. But the normal Protestant ideal is individual judgment, individual responsibility, with an authoritarian Bible and not an authoritarian church. Okay? That more sort of marks this out. We have an authoritarian Bible as opposed to an authoritarian church. Okay? Now, all the factions that you had in Europe before the colonies were ever established, and they had to be within church-state relationships in Europe, are perpetuated in the United States as denominations. They couldn't exist in Europe. It's impossible under the social system and under the law system of Europe. So it just took time for that to run its course in the United States. So that by the time you get to the turn of the century, the 19th century in the United States, you just have hundreds of sects, Protestant sects, in the United States. The fourth outstanding characteristic. By the way, within the Roman Catholic Church, you have a lot of sectarianism. For instance, we just had a case here where we have a left-wing Roman Catholic priest that the Bishop of Denver would not recognize, and now he's been forced to recognize him within the last week. There was enough pressure brought to bear. Well, that left-wing priest has now said, I don't agree with the bishop, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Denver, theologically. And yet he's under his jurisdiction in terms of authority. Well, if you know the history of the Catholic Church, it's permeated with denominational concepts. And all the ascetic groups, all the orders, the Jesuits, the Augustinians, Franciscans, Domitian, no, that's not right, Augustine, which one am I thinking of? Dominicans? All these orders are kind of shades of denominations within the Roman Catholic structure. But their rallying point, you see, is an authoritative person, a pope. Well, the fourth outstanding thing that happens in terms of development is a practical and anti-intellectual tendency. A practical and an anti-intellectual develops in Protestant, what are called Protestant churches. The trend for practicality, an outstanding characteristic. Their methods of promotion and propagation, their interest in practical life with little attention to theoretical and intellectual problems is characteristic of the Protestant Church. This was not true of Jonathan Edwards. It was not true of many of the Puritan preachers of the colonial period. But this bent is very evident in fundamentalism and in conservative Christianity today, where higher education is often equated with modernism and liberalism. And if you are often, if you are a person that has a certain number of degrees, you're looked upon as being probably more of a liberal person. And you are not practical enough in your approach to Christianity. This is an outstanding characteristic of fundamentalism and of conservative evangelical Christianity today. Okay? The last outstanding principle is Americanization. Americanization. This is the concept of being practical. Businessmen-like approach, or the business-like approach. Optimistic. Never give up. Just split the church and go start another one. And that one will really turn all right, because we know what we're doing and we're heading it up. I was in contradistinction to that. I was ministering with a group in which the leaders took the opposite view. They said, we are staying within our church even though we know it's not any good. The doctrinal statement stinks, but we're the only Christians in there. And I said, well, what do you do about your children? They said, well, that's the big problem. We just don't know what to do about our children, because we know they're getting taught the wrong thing. I said, well, why don't you start another church? And they says, well, we know that within 30 years or 35 years, it would go bad anyhow. And I says, yeah, but 35 years down the road isn't your responsibility. What your responsibility is right now. What my responsibility is right now. And I don't have to worry about 50 years or 30 years from now. I have to worry about my responsibility right now. The normal situation is the optimistic approach, and in some cases the concept of social consciousness. In other words, we live in Cherry Hills, where we couldn't think of going to a Bible church. When we identify with a church, probably Episcopal, something to that effect. Unconventional atmospheres. Anything that speaks of being stiff or formal is shunned by the average American. consequently would be out. And our churches are manifestations of these attitudes, okay? And these have been encouraged by these concepts of separation of church and state, the concepts of self-governing, the concepts of self-sustaining churches. You see, have made sort of an emphasis on individualism within Protestantism that has been very, very healthy. And in this country, unhampered by limitations of standardized traditions or any dictation from the state, the churches have been free to develop, you see, on the basis of any inner strength that they have. And it's been basically a good thing. Now, we're not talking here about theological distinctions in terms of characteristics of the Protestant American churches. What we're simply talking about is some of the key underlining attitudes and character of all Protestantism. Okay? Any questions? By the way, it's interesting that as we approach or as we reach the 1976, as we reach close to the end of the 20th century, that denominations are tending to be weaker and weaker and weaker, whereas independent movements are tending to be stronger and stronger and stronger. For example, the problem of maintaining a seminary is almost overtaxing to denominations now. They can hardly do it. First of all, they don't have enough students. They don't have people that are interested. They don't have the monies to support the schools that they once had, so they're closing down and they're consolidating, just like many private schools are doing. But within the independent movements, sort of the faith movements, the seminaries are growing. They're larger and larger. For instance, Dallas Seminary this year it's probably the largest seminary in the world now, 800 students. They do not even take part-time students anymore at that school. You have to be a full-time student to enroll there. Faith Seminary, which is going through a number of splits and divisions and problems, still has a strong school. Talbot Seminary is strong, large. And the next largest school, I guess, would be Trinity Seminary in Dearborn or Deerfield, Illinois. See what I'm saying? As we move down, the denominations, if a church is going under, like this church is financially the last 2 months, then a denominational church just calls headquarters and says, we need money. We're going to need some extra money. And so they get a check in the mail. But the independent churches can't do that. They have to think up other gimmicks. See? Well, the independent churches have to survive on the basis of their inherent inner strength, or they don't cut it. And the same way with these schools. So what I'm saying essentially is that as we're moving down through time, the strength and the character of the churches, the lines are being drawn where it's becoming more clear which are the stronger and which are the weaker churches in terms of their own inner strength. Repeat, the course of American history or the movement of American history can be looked upon as an experiment in religious expression and the opportunity for religious expression. We enjoy in this country probably the greatest freedom and liberty than in any place in the world. And we ought not to slough it off and treat it lightly. We ought to appreciate it and understand it and take advantage of it. Are there any questions I can answer? Yes, Jay?
What is the change in the weakening of the denominations? How does that affect the concept?
I think my own concept of denominationalism is that it is a perversion of true New Testament church doctrine. In other words, I would be considered an anti-denominationalist within my own frame of reference, the way I understand the Bible. And one of the ways denominations get started was on this Americanization concept that they are more practical. In other words, if you talk to somebody who understands the issue, one of the defenses they'll bring up of a denominational system is you can get more done through a denomination than you can through an individual local church or by churches remaining independent. It becomes an argument that they have. More evangelism, you can exert more pressure on Congress, you can in legislatures, you can have more an effect on your community because you present a front, sort of a Christian united front to a community and so on. It's much more practical from their posture. But there are other problems associated with it. I'm not trying to sell it to you. I'm just saying that my attitude toward this is that regardless of some of this, you have none of the dictation nor the ecclesiasticism that just comes right along with it. You know, he who pays the bills usually calls the shots. That works pretty true in a home as well as in a government as well as in church. And so when you accept the denominations, you have to accept a certain amount of ecclesiasticism. For example, we had some people in this church that left the Baptist church that they were in because the denomination sent $10,000 for the defense of Angela Davis. And there were a lot more things wrong with that denomination than just that. That was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in these people's minds. They had no say where that went and so on, you see. They couldn't raise their voice in protest to that. It was done from some headquarters in the American Baptist Convention. My understanding of it, now if I'm trying to get back to your question. I think denominationalism is a form of a perversion of the New Testament doctrine of the church. So I don't see any threat to the if that's what you're implying in your question,
I
Jerry.
I guess I'm wondering if you have a weakening in the denominational system, do you not then have a fragmentation? And because you have more individual small groups, do you have less of a drive towards the individual non-believer and person that would be open to the world?
Well, I don't think the last part is necessarily true, but you do have an anarchical, and that's one of the that's one of the problems that I try to point out here under the voluntary system. Whenever you have this thing of volition, you can then have anarchy. Now, anarchy is disrespect for authority, a form of disrespect for authority. Yes, you do have that. This is one of the problems of the independent churches. A believer can have an anarchical mind, and he just is irresponsible. It's terrible. You see it everywhere. You see it all over the doctrinal movement, everywhere. See? So, however, the latter part of your statement, I don't know that that's necessarily true. It appears to me that the emphasis of the New Testament is on individual local churches feeding, encouraging, exhorting believers that identify with it voluntarily so that they go out and evangelize. And then out from them, there begins other churches because people move away or they're in another part of a community, and so they say, hey, we need an independent autonomous church. And really, that's healthy. That's really healthy. For example, from this church, I was the other day I was recounting in my mind some very strong families that have moved away from here in the last 3 years. Now, almost in every case of those families, they are very, very much involved wherever the Lord has put them, in ministry of the word. They are teachers now. And God is using them to help establish Bible-oriented, Bible-centered churches. I think it's a very, very healthy sign. I don't know if that answers your question. Is there any other question? Try to answer. One of the problems, for example, that brings up, and perhaps we could demonstrate, is the problem of the schools. See? A school is not a church. Where will the school draw its resources to function? Well, within a denomination, it's very easy. We want $50 from this church. We want $100 from that church. We want it per capita, per person. You see, and you sort of, in headquarters, levies a tax on you to support the school. So then you have the budget of the school underwritten. See? Well, what about us then? Do we have a responsibility to a school? Well, we should. We should. Well, we've, as a board, felt that as a responsibility. We wanted to support some Negro schools. We felt that they definitely were schools that really needed help, and there were so very few of them, and we contacted several, and their doctrinal statements were such that we just didn't feel that we could support them. So the closest thing now that we have would be Emmanuel School that he's trying to establish. As a good doctrinal basis, if that can be maintained. So they're drawing now from this fellowship, I think, around $85 a month support. But we, a local church that considers itself independent, and independent really isn't the right word, is it, for the New Testament concept of the body of Christ. We're dependent. See, we're dependent on one another. But independent, when you use it in a healthy sense, means that we don't look outside of this church for resources, for sustenance for the church. See? But at the same time, we don't look at ourselves as isolated and irresponsible towards these other organizations that are good and necessary and needful. Okay. Yes?
You made a comment first of the surge regarding what interfaces should be between church and state. You said originally there was a theocracy, there was a theocratic basis, and then Democratic basis without a way in the separation between church and state. You seem to indicate you were leading towards what you suggest would be the happy middle of that system.
Well, I feel that that it's wrong to think that you can have, well, let's not put it that way. It's to think that there is a Christian nation is to be naive. And there has been a Christian nation. Perhaps the closest thing to it would be South Korea, and now they're having problems with dictatorship. It seems to me that that wherever you have a state, that recognizes divine institutions, and not necessarily uniting itself with the church, but recognizes the validity of divine institution and allows for the maximum expression of these without contradiction. That I'm talking now about a theoretical view of the state. I'm not talking about the church at all now. That you will have the best opportunity for healthy function of its citizens and relationships toward one another. Now, you might say the United States in our Constitution is an experiment in that also. But now we're having problems with morality and responsibility in marriage, in family, and our law fits into that. And I don't know the answers. I really don't. I know that you can't legislate morality, but I also know that by having certain laws that you can affect what is acceptable and unacceptable in a culture or a society so that it does not become accepted. It is unacceptable and it is rejected by the society. And by virtue of the law, the practice of that which is not acceptable is limited. But how far you take that without violating volition gets confusing to me. I have never seen a pornographic movie. Volitionally, I don't want to see any. I've got too much hormone problem now. I don't need any more. And now, do we make a law that people can't go to pornographic movies? Well, there you limit volition, don't you? But you protect morality. It gets extremely complex in my thinking. I need some help with that. I really do. Sometimes I say, oh, boy, how can we tolerate this any longer? Let's go down and close them up. This makes me sick that we would even tolerate this. Even the ads in the paper, they're so stupid and ridiculous. It's a commentary on the mentality of this culture that we live in. Well, you know, how do you limit that and yet allow for this? I don't know. I'm confused about that. Now, in terms of relationship to the church, however, I think the system that we have is just super. Super. Complete separation of church and state should be maintained and fought for. Totally. But the perversion that's coming now is the perversion of separation of state and God, so that you have a secularized society. Now, the men that have to fight that battle are the men who are Christians and legislators who are Christians, or at least theists. And brother, I want to tell you, they need your prayers. And some of these men who stand up in a state legislature relative to some of these issues, I admire those men. They speak out. And they're trying to hold back some of these liberal concepts that were very destructive to particularly marriage and family and responsibility. And I appreciate those guys. They need our prayers and our support. Well, have we answered anything? I don't know. Yes? Her?
I wonder how the church has been able to stay free of government intervention, the government and the family and the business.
In this country, there's an easy answer to that. It's because those people in the time the Constitution were written were knowledgeable enough. They knew what would happen in Europe, and they says, we do not want that here under any circumstances. And so every time that it would rear its ugly head, there was enough public opinion that would just wipe it out. I mean, they didn't have a chance. You had the Huguenots who had been, you know, hundreds of thousands of Huguenots in France had been murdered hundreds in the St. Bartholomew Day massacre. And then after the Edict of Nantes was revoked by Louis XIV, 600,000 of them either died or left France. You had the problem of all the Anabaptists in the Germanies, the duchies, the various aspects that were then Germany. There was no Germany. You had the problem of the Puritans in England, you see.
Yeah, but the letter to the Constitution didn't want government into the business and welfare and all those things. And yet we have that today. But what?
Well, now you haven't. There's been.
They were just as much against these incursions of the government into all other areas of our life as they were the religious. And yet, well, the other religious seems to have escaped the government control.
Well, it's because it's one of the signs of that is because of the strength.
Maybe the church has been more.
The strength of the churches in this country has been such that is a sign of that. The incursion of government into business, and you know, has been rather rapid. Rapid, historically speaking, since Roosevelt, I would almost say. Sherman Antitrust Acts, of course, antedate him back in the after the turn of the century. But as far as really any super incursion into business, they've been rather rapid, prepared by a socialist mentality that has swept Western civilization in a sense.
Maybe now there's all that little interest in the church per se, that people are just kind of ignoring it and don't care about government or not. There's many people about that, perhaps.
Well, I think that the government messed with the church, they'd have their hands full again today. I think they really would. I think it's that strong. The hue and cry over the prayer thing was an indication of that. But I think much of the hue and cry over the prayer thing is because of misleading information about that. Any other question we can answer? Try to answer. Well, I fully, with the background that I have, my background is in history, is in Europe mainly. And you just can't imagine what it is to be born in a system where if you are not baptized, if we're not baptized, you are not a citizen of the state, you are under the ban, where your monies and your efforts and your energies went to something that you supported whether you liked it or not. And we have a system that sort of shook us free of that by that First Amendment, if by nothing else. There were attitudes that built up to that. But it shook us free of that happening in this country. And the good that's come out of that in terms of the inherent strength of the evangelical church, we enjoy that today. And we ought to capitalize on it. We ought to really, hold it dear to ourselves. Well, next week we're going to start, as I said, a series on the biblical doctrine of predestination and election, and we'll leave this for a while. Shall we close in prayer? We thank you, our Father, for that which is behind us historically in this country, and we know not how long you'll let this nation survive. We are fearful for the violation of principles which you've established for the survival of nation states in a sinful cosmos, and the threat to marriage and family and responsibility by the immorality and by the self-indulgence that permeates the attitudes of many people of our nation. We pray, our Father, that our influence as believers will be felt. First of all, that we'll be strong enough to express it intelligently and scripturally, and that it will be felt. We know and we take great confidence in the fact that this is not the only nation in time that has experienced this type of decay. And we pray that you will stir believers to express themselves while we still have opportunity. For we ask it in Christ's name with thanksgiving. Amen.